can even go online at kpft.org to make your pledge. Your pledge is essential to keep listener sponsorship viable for generations to come. So call 713-526-4000 to support KPFT. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston.
From the team on So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted to storytelling, and you're going to find it only here on listener-sponsored KPFT Houston. I'm your host and producer, Hank Rubicek, and along with the best team on radio, Greg Audell, Warren Holloman, Mary Edgerton, Eric Hain, Christy Gorman, Harwood Taylor, and Tatiana Gago, we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on astonishing journeys before returning us safely to the present. You know, a while back, I mentioned to my team a storyteller that I greatly admired, someone I came to know through his remarkable memoir, The Beggar King and The Secret of Happiness. I proclaimed that I would one day schedule him as a guest on our show, and then a few days later, co-host Eric Hain, in Only He Could Do, said, "I got him." "Who?" I asked. "Joel Ben Izzy." My immediate response was, "Get the hell out of town." But he said, "Oh, no, no, I really got him." Well, tonight makes his third appearance, because as tonight's host, I wanted him to be our first guest for 2021. And you're going to soon know why. Because he has a way of helping us do what we so desperately need, to be lifted. It was 1983 when Joel Ben Izzy graduated from Stanford with a degree in English, creative writing, and storytelling, and then set off to travel the world telling tales. His treks have taken him around the world and back again, gathering and telling stories to a variety of audiences in over 30 countries and 5 continents, and in venues ranging from the Tokyo Jewish Community Center to a bomb shelter in Jerusalem. The aforementioned Beggar King has been translated into 13 languages. His second book, Dreidels on the Brain, is a young adult coming-of-age Hanukkah novel selected as a finalist for the National Jewish Book Award. Joel has also recorded and produced 6 CDs, all receiving awards from the American Library Association, Parents' Choice Foundation, and more. Other Facebook pages say something about Joel, but not like ours. If you take a look at ours, it's going to uncover more about Joel than you'll want to read, but you'll want to read it all. But nothing reveals his persona more than the way he renders life through stories. Well, Happy New Year, you guys. We finally meet, right? As I was mentioning just a few moments ago, it's ironic how this dreaded pandemic actually brings us together face to face, albeit virtually.
Happy New Year to you as well. And sometimes I think if we could just sell irony on the wholesale market, we'd all be wealthy.
I love it. And, you know, Joel, other than the fact that we're obviously much younger and better looking than you ever imagined, is there anything that comes to mind that shocks you?
Not shocked, just delighted. You know, when you, it's sort of the magic of story and the magic of radio. You see someone's face as you hear their voice, you know, and I'm always hearing voices. I remember meeting Terry Gross once, and I'd never seen a picture of her. And then when I happened to run into her in a radio station, KQED in San Francisco, here was this woman speaking with Terry Gross's voice. And I said, "You're not Terry Gross. You can't be Terry Gross." And then she said, and very much she was Terry Gross.
Right.
And then she switched subjects and said, "Well, what do you do?" And, you know, I'm pretty comfortable talking, but it's the only time I've ever been tongue-tied, because I thought, oh, my God, Terry Gross is asking me a question, and it's so insightful, and it's, you know, it's, and how do I answer it? And so I said, more or less, well, I kind of do this thing that's performance, but not writing. And it's, I suppose it involves stories. She said, oh, you're a storyteller. I thought, my God, she's brilliant. So anyway, I'm glad to see you in person, virtually. And you look like you sound, which is a compliment.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And you are, at the risk of embarrassing you, you are one of the best and frankly the best storyteller I know personally. And that is beyond a compliment because Eric and I are picky people, but you're awfully good at what you did and at what you do. And as you know, I use your book in my class and students love you. So you are so welcome. Earlier, I said that we need to be lifted. And for most storytellers, Joel, as you know, lifting spirits comes from the strength found in vulnerability. And we need a safe space to feel vulnerable, and stories seem to work as that space. It's that channel because we give ourselves permission to tell stories. One of the things that I find astonishing about you is that you do have a way of giving people permission to tell stories. We open our windows to our soul. And so tonight, we go to the well, which is a perfect theme, as you suggested. And don't think for a moment, listeners, that you don't have a well with stories to tell. It's not empty. And that is where our program begins. So with that fact, Joel, take it away.
All right. Well, I just have to first say what a great way this is to start off the new year. And I have never seen people want to get rid of an old year like people wanted to put 2020 behind them. And I imagine many of your listeners feel the same. And you know, in that spirit, I was thinking, well, what would be a good gift to give your listeners in terms of stories for this year? Something beyond, you know, me simply telling stories. I wanted to take a little further. And, you know, just in reflecting on that, I realized one of the things about stories is that they are sometimes better to hear and listen to and enjoy than to live through. And we have all been living through a big, big story. I would technically say it's a big honking story. I mean, I would say we have been through one of those times in history that we will look back and say, oh, there was a before, there was a during, there was an after. It's kind of like I collected coins for a while as a kid, and maybe it was 1944, the pennies were steel, if I remember the year right, and you'd see, or zinc maybe, and you'd say, wow, that must have been a wild year. So this has been a year like no other. And yet, being in the midst of a story can really suck. I don't have to tell you this, Dr. Hank. You've had your own adventures with COVID, which we might talk about later. But it's so painful sometimes because you don't know how it's going to end. You don't know where it's going. And so what I thought about was actually I thought about something I've been doing really since writing that book, The Beggar King and the Secret of Happiness. That book tells a story that began when I woke up from a surgical procedure to discover I could no longer speak. And at first the doctors thought it was temporary. Then they decided it was permanent, that I'd never be able to speak again. And that set me off on a journey. You know, so many journeys that we go on are, well, they begin as a schlep more than a journey. They're not journeys we want to take. So in thinking about that, you know, of course, my voice, much to my surprise, came back long after I'd given up hope. And therein lies that story. But it left me with a taste to help other people find and tell their stories. And I've been doing a lot of that lately. And the concept that I think of is one I learned from my wife on our wedding day. It's called The Well. And it was a day, I mean, we just celebrated last May, 30 years married. And we're remembering back to our wedding day. And it was a day with a lot of drama leading up to it. And there's been a lot of drama since then. That's life. But it turned to be just one of those magnificent, perfect days with the people and the setting. It was just one of those moments in time. And as I tried to be able to take it all in, I said, Tali, there's just too much here. I can't take it all in. I don't know what to do. And she said, you know, Joel, we have to think of this as though we are filling up a well. It is a well that we can go back to for the rest of our lives. It's filled with our friends, our family, their love, their good wishes, because it won't always be like this. And when it's not, when we have difficult times, we can go to the well. And I love that image, and I love my wife that she came up with that. It's very wise. And what I've come to realize over time is this notion of the well isn't merely something that my wife said to me on our wedding day. It is really what we all do. We go through our lives and we fill up a well. And that well is filled with memories of places we've been, with people who maybe we met them and maybe they were meaningful to us, filled with bits of music that touch our soul. Each one of us has a well like that, and we're continually filling it up. But I think what we forget to do is to go back and see what's in that well. And that's part of storytelling, really, because stories come from this well. And so what I have really is an invitation to you and to your listeners to be able to go to the well. And I'll tell you how I do it. And this was a lesson I learned from my daughter. Her name was Michaela, but she just goes by Izzy Ben Izzy. And it was actually not from her, but from her preschool teacher. In preschool, they did an experiment where they took a glass of water and they poured, it was like hot water, and they poured sugar in it and stirred it around until it all dissolved. Then they took a pencil and tied a string around it and rested that pencil with a string on the top of the glass with the string hanging in the water. And over time, you know, the kids checked each day. Eventually, that string began to form crystals, and those crystals were essentially candy, which the kids then took off and ate, and they thought this was a great result for this experiment. So it was an experiment really about science, not really about health, I don't think, because they were eating sugar. But the point was a good one. I thought, you know, metaphorically, that's what stories are. When you say to someone the eponymous phrase, that is, so what's your story? It's kind of hard to know how to answer. It's not because we don't have stories. It's because we all have so many stories. And so the technique that I use to help people find them, and that I want to invite you to do, and it's great to have Eric here too, so you can both do this, the two of you and then everybody out there listening, is to just find that path to the well. And of course, getting to the well is important. It's especially important in difficult times. And we are in the midst of difficult times. So the invitation is to go to the well. And what I do that with is what I call a story string, like the string that they dropped in the glass of sugar water. Just one sort of a story string that helps you find your way to the realm of story. Now, there's story and there's story, and of course, there's story. And there are sometimes stories. So people, you know, we tell stories and we think, oh, well, you know, so-and-so knows a story. And you have wonderful stories. But I'm talking about story as a place we go to. So what I want to do is give the two of you, Eric and Hank, a prompt and then give you some time to think about it. Because just like if you dip that string in and pull it right out and nothing happens, I want to give about 35, maybe 40 seconds for you to consider this prompt. And then we'll sort of simply see what came up and see what's there in the well for you. And I'll give a little chime before we start. So here's the prompt. I want you to think, you and your listeners, to think of a place you used to love to go. And as you think about this, really, generally, the first one that comes to your mind is a good one to go with. I'd like you to think about that place and think about it with all your senses. So I'd like to invite you to actually see that place, of course, and hear what you hear there, smell what you smell, taste what you taste, and feel what you feel, which is of course, a rainbow of those springs. And maybe because of that place, it was a place if you used to love to go. Imagine arriving at that place, that is approaching. And let yourself wander and see what it is you see there and hear and smell and taste and feel and who might be there. And you might find something there that you'll bring back. So what I'm going to do is give the chimes, and then I want to give you 40 seconds, say, just to let yourself go to that place you used to love to go. For you,
listeners, this all means you too.
That's right. That's right. I'll start with a chime, and I'll end with a chime, and then we'll see where we went in the realm of story. Think of a place you used to love to go, starting now. All right. Now, the thing about stories is they find other stories. I'm very curious where either of you went to during that time and place.
I'm going to yield to Eric first.
Well, Joe, what immediately came to me was this small reservoir that was not far from my hometown where we used to go swimming. And the feeling when I'd approach that, you know, the memories are just, you know, like you were talking about the sensual feel, what you see, what you smell. And for some reason, I started smelling the cow manure. There's something nostalgic about the sense of smell. And whenever there'd be cows in that lake, the manure smell would be very, very strong, but we'd swim anyway. So when you gave me that prompt, it brought me back to this reservoir and the smell of cow manure.
I love it. And it's sometimes the things that bring us in the stories aren't the obvious ones, like the smell of cow manure. Hank, where did you go?
Well, I didn't go to Hebrew school, I can tell you that. Hebrew school was not that. So, no. But I went, this was a great one. It was two places which belong together. I can't go to one without the other. It was the Cedar and Leaf Theater on Cedar Road in Cleveland Heights, Ohio. And right next door was Mobby's Hamburgers. Now, both of you may or may not agree with me. It's okay. It doesn't make any difference. But Mobby's made the best hamburgers on the planet. That doesn't mean one or two countries. I do mean the planet. And you could look it up. What they did was to grow their onions and paprika. They used to chop up their burgers, but not entirely, just deep enough where you could put the onions. And the hamburger was so delectable that I taste it every day. I try to duplicate it at home, but forget about that. And afterwards, we go to a movie. Now, the movie was always a matinee. And the best thing about going to the movie is that despite what would be playing, Tarzan, Abbott and Costello, or, you know, Abbott and Costello meet Tarzan, regardless of what it would be, after the first matinee, and I told this in a story once, I think Eric remembers, my friend and I used to duck down to avoid the usher who would come by getting ready for the second showing, and we pop up and watch that second one. But it had to be the hamburgers first, you see. If Wobbies was ever closed, which it never was, it didn't make the movie the same. You had to eat the hamburger and then see the movie. So it's Mobby's and the Cedar Leaf Theater, inextricably related. Now, I know you had relatives in Cleveland, don't you?
I did in Cleveland Heights and in Mayfield Heights as well. And it was far away. But I never heard about Mobby, but now it's indelibly sealed. Now I want to go there, get a Mobby's hamburger.
Well, they're no longer there, and that's the problem. That's why it's a memory. As a matter of fact, I keep journals, and it's in my journal. It's Mawby. You guys need to look it up. Good research for you.
You know, I kind of love this in that, you know, the saying is, in the world of stories, nothing is lost. And it's funny, in the opening of The Beggar King, I use that as an opening quote, and I attributed it to Isaac Bashevis Singer, but I think I was wrong, because I've not been able to find it. I think I made that up and then attributed it to him accidentally. I think we have to correct it in the next version. But the idea is that it's all there. And for people who have been feeling isolated, sequestered, alone, being able to go to the well, you know, in reality, you can't go back to Mobbies. And Eric, I'm guessing you wouldn't necessarily go swim in that reservoir with the steer manure. And yet you can in the memory. And that's something stories do for us. Let's try another little prompt very quickly for you. But by the way, as people in your listeners hear these, of course, they have stories too. Now, they may be with someone and they can share the stories, or they may simply want to reach out somebody, call somebody and say, you know, I was just listening to the thing on the radio and I was just, there was an assignment. I didn't know who to tell about it, so I thought I'd tell you.
Or please feel free to share it on our Facebook page.
Oh, absolutely. Of course. Absolutely. On the Facebook page, where you went, what you did. And of course, we start with the string, with the crystals that are formed. We end up with a description, which is a wonderful starting place for a story. And when it goes from a description to a story, is a process. There's a sort of a story template that goes once upon a time, every day, then one day, because of that, ever since, until finally. So what happens is, with the beginnings, both of you went to sort of once upon a time, or when I was a kid in Cleveland, or when I was used to go to the reservoir. Those kind of feel like those natural beginnings. Every day, every day, every day. You know, every time we went to the movie theater, we'd go to, you know, we had to go to Mobbies, right? And every time we'd hide behind the sink, behind the seat when they came to collect tickets. When you get to and then one day, that's when the story launches as what we think of as a story. And that's a story spine that we all know. Let's try another one, though, just to see what else is in the well. I want to invite the two of you and your listeners to think about a teacher that you remember. And of course, Hank, I say this knowing that you are a teacher and a beloved one. I want you to think about a teacher that you remember. And as you do, I'd like you to go back to that time and place, and probably that first one that comes to mind is a good one. We have many teachers in our life, but go with the first one. And let yourself imagine that scene. And maybe it was a particular time of day you would see that teacher, a particular time of year you'd see that teacher. Let yourself go to that place. And then again, use your sensory details. See what's around there. Hear what you hear. Feel the temperature, the place, the time of day, the smells, the sounds, the tastes. And you maybe even hear that teacher's voice. And it may be, if that teacher was, maybe that teacher taught you something that you will always remember, that you remember now. And again, I want to invite you and your listeners to go back, give you 40 seconds, let yourself go back to that teacher that you remember, the time, the place. Go back there with all your senses and see if there's something that you learned from that teacher. 40 seconds with a chime starting now. All right, let's hear about a teacher from either of you.
Well, for me, it was easy. Claire McElfresh, he got an honorary doctorate, so we called him Dr. Mac. But Dr. McElfresh was our high school choir. We had the best choir in the country. I know that's another bold statement, but we did. the Cleveland Heights High School Choir. We made albums. We went to Bermuda. We were asked to go to Romania, but we couldn't because Nixon wouldn't let us go that year. There was some political agitation going on. He was more of an choir director. He took average people with virtually no voices and identified resources in us we never knew we had available, which I think is something that all teachers do. He died recently. I kept in contact with him many of these years. As Eric knows, I love keeping in contact with people who are meaningful to me, and I kept in contact with him. He died 6 years ago. He was at Florida International University, one of the founders, actually. But this was at Cleveland Heights High School, and he was notorious for these early rehearsals, which, my God, it didn't make any difference. If you were dead, you had to find a way to show up. They were at 7 o'clock in the morning in the winters of Cleveland, Ohio. Yeah. And they were tough. They were always a snowstorm. And we had to get there at 7 o'clock, and he meant 7 o'clock. If it was 7:01, we had section leaders who would give you a demerit. And when we would ask him, well, whose clock matters? He says, mine matters. Here's my clock. And he was such a stickler for discipline, but somehow, some way, he took average voices, honest to God. You can listen to us on YouTube. We made albums, and he identified these resources that we didn't have available. And, you know, I also want to add that I was very fortunate because, you know, I mean, my grandmother knew I was a creative person. I like to read. I like to bang on pots in her basement. She used to wonder why that would help me become a heart surgeon, but nevertheless. So when I told her I'd like to sing, she loved that. But at first she said, choir, really? But when she met him, she recognized the power of a teacher and the kind of generic implications and the kind of incredible influence they have on you. So I always get excited when I think about Claire McElfresh. The fact is that most of my other teachers sucked, which is why I became one, but that's a different story.
Oh, Hank, that is just really, really lovely. And first, may Claire McElfresh, may Doc McElfresh's memory, or Doc Claire's memory be for a blessing. And if I'm correct, it was Heights High Tigers, wasn't it?
Right. Good for you, right? My Cleveland Heights High School, right.
My mother
Shaker,
went to
Shaker. Reunion. Shaker Heights were the rich people and our rivals.
No, that my mother went to Heights High Reunion for years and years. She was in that same high school like years before you. It just brings back that memories of she used to talk about it and the friends she made. I wonder if she was ever in choir. It's a good question. But what I love is that he helped you find resources you didn't know you had. And this is, so, and there's a lot, you know, for listeners, what you might do, I just recommend things because stories, you know, are alive and waiting to be told. Listeners, if you thought of a teacher who was beloved to you, in addition to posting on the Facebook page for So What's Your Story, you might actually reach out to that teacher through the years, and you can find people on the internet and reach out and just say, and tell them a story. Say, you know, I was listening to this radio show, and this guy Joel gave a prompt about a teacher, remember? And I thought of you and wanted to let you know that. So thank you, Hank. Eric, who did you go to see?
Well, my school days are kind of a blur, but I went all the way back to my, as a middle school, I guess they call it down here. It's about 13. And we had this history teacher. She was quite elderly, very good teacher, soft-spoken, but she had a very pronounced limp. It was like a sailboat going way over to the side and back. And so, of course, at that age, we boys, we'd make fun of her and behind her back. And one day, I remember I was trying to impress the other kids as a class clown. And she was walking down the hall. And I said, watch this. So I got right up behind her and I mocked her limp just perfectly, back and forth, just shouted her down the hallway. Everybody got a kick out of it. And the next time we had that class, when the class ended, she said, "Eric, could you come up here?" And right there in front of everybody, she said, "If you ever do that again, I'm going to kick your ass," because she somehow saw. But what struck me is she didn't say anything out there in the hallway. I don't know why, but she just shocked us because she's so soft-spoken. She's the last one we would expect to hear say, "I'm going to kick your ass." But she said that right in front of the class. Major impact on me. So I straightened up after that.
I love that.
I love that. And I love also, in terms of story structure, it's a beautiful story. And, you know, it's a story you might not have thought of telling as a story. I don't know if you've told this story before because you tell stories, but that's the sorts of stories I love, is people who are, when you say, "So what's your story?" You know, those stories hidden beneath the surface. But one thing that I love that you did, Eric, is you demonstrated how that story spine works. And I was talking about, you know, so every day, you know, I was in school and we had this teacher with a limp and we would always do this. And then one day, and you said the words "one day." Right. So, and we heard one day, we knew that something was going to happen. Something was going to turn. And then, you know, and that was the buildup of suspense. She said, "I'm going to kick your ass." You know, and ever since then, I straightened up. So that's what we find, I think, and what I hope your listeners find, is that we have a lot more story material than we realize.
Right.
And a little bit of structure turns it into that material, turns that a description of a story. And then as you tell these, of course, you haven't rehearsed or prepared these stories.
No.
These are just stories you share from the place of story, which is different than performing, right? So as your listeners get to, you know, you bring on these fantastic storytellers, but what's important is that your listeners don't feel intimidated and say, "Oh, I could never tell a story like Elizabeth Ellis or, you know, whoever you have." No, they say, "Oh, I have stories too," and they find ways to tell them. You know what I think I'll do is I have a list of some favorite story strings. Maybe I'll send them to you. You can put them on your email page. I'll also put in that story spine so people have it handy. And it came from a book called How to Improvise a Full-Length Play. And I'll send the name there so that we can credit that. But just thank you both for those.
Oh, thank you. I'm laughing because, you know, Eric's story is so Eric. It's so Eric. Let me do just a couple of announcements that I want to get back to Joel, because I know you've got a couple of stories that I think are very appropriate for tonight. But this is Hank Rubicek, and you are listening to the 2021 debut of So What's Your Story with guest master storyteller, my friend, Mr. Joel Benizzi, and co-host Eric Hain on KPFT Houston, 89.5 in Galveston and 91.9 on the dial for our friends in Huntsville. You know, even during the pandemic, our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, is a great place to turn to develop and nurture your storytelling skills. Participants from around the country Zoom in the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. The next swap is Tuesday, January 26th, so please visit the Guild's website at www.HoustonStorytellers.org for details and the Zoom invite link along with upcoming events. And while you're on the Guild's page, why not become a member? It's easy. Join our past So What's Your Story programs and listen to them as well. Every one of them since 2008 is there under menu, under program, radio program, excuse me, under the menu. And if you don't own a radio, don't worry about it. But it is 2021. You might want to think about buying one. I don't know. But you can listen to us stream live on kpft.org and Facebook. Now, back to Joel. Joel, you know, I had asked you to choose a couple of stories that might be appropriate for tonight. And the truth is, all of them are, and that's no hyperbole. And speaking of the truth, something we've been seeking collectively, I think, for the better part of 2020, I think listeners will want to hear the strawberry. And then you've got another quickie called the blind monk. Would you share those with us?
Sure, I'd love to. Yeah, we're seeking the truth and seeking something beautiful to hold on to, I think. You know, because the sadness and loss makes us appreciate the beauty. And I'll just mention that story Spine, the credit goes to Ken Adams, who wrote a book called How to Improvise a Full-Length Play. And it's K-E-N-N-A-D-A-M-S. So it's two N's, one D, but the second N in Ken is silent. So K-E-N-N Adams. So, you know, I was thinking about a lot of the great stories leave us with questions. And I love Zen stories for this. So one tells of a monk who was blind, and he would go to leave his monastery and go down to visit a friend in a village that sort of was through the valley and up the mountains on the other side. And he knew the way. He'd found his way there before. And one day as he was visiting his friend, a fellow monk, it was time for him to leave. And his friend said, oh, you'd better take a lantern with you to go back. And the blind monk said, why? I have no need of a lantern. I'm blind. And his friend said, yes, but the lantern will help others to see you. And so he took the lantern and dutifully carried it back home. And as he was making the way down the path he knew so well, he was walking and suddenly, bam, bumped right into somebody else. And the monk said, you fool, didn't you see my lantern? And the ending line of the story, you've got a couple choices, which I love that in stories. One, I think the way I first read it was the friend said, I'm sorry, your lantern has burned out. And the blind monk hadn't known it. The other one, though, which I think I came up with years later, always intrigued me, was, you fool, didn't you see my lantern? I'm sorry, I'm blind. The stories that open us up for questions, for wonder, and I think most importantly for gratitude, because that's really the ticket to getting through difficult times and good times. And this is a story I've always loved. This is another monk who was traveling in business somewhere, I think off in Thailand. And I don't know, he was a little bit late and he had to get back to the train station, and he was sort of rushing and took what he thought was a shortcut, but in fact it seemed to be a little unfamiliar, and it was getting kind of dark. And as he walked, he kicked a rock and didn't hear it land, and suddenly he stopped and he realized he'd come to the edge of a huge cliff. And unthinkingly, he was just about to walk right off that cliff. And he looked down and thought, oh my God, look at how close I came to falling off that cliff. He turned to backtrack, and there behind him was a Bengal tiger, just walking slowly towards him. And the monk stepped slowly back a little bit, but there wasn't much back to go, and sort of tried to move to the side and then slipped. And the next thing he knew, hands flying over feet, over hands, over feet, tumbling, he found himself on the side of the cliff holding onto a vine, cutting into his hand, and looking about 10 feet above him was that tiger. And then he looked all the way down at the bottom where he dropped his bag, and there at the bottom of the cliff was another tiger. And as he looked at a tiger above and a tiger below, he looked panicked, looking for something, and he saw not far from the little vine he was holding was a little hole. And out from that hole came a little mouse, a black and white mouse. It crawled along a ledge, looked up at one tiger, looked down at the other, and then began gnawing away at the vine. He looked at the tiger, and he looked at the other tiger, he looked at the mouse. He looked around for something, anything else to grab onto. He saw a little plant, but couldn't possibly hold his weight, but he reached towards it, a little plant with green leaves, and he parted the green leaves, and there behind the green leaves, he saw something red. A strawberry, a wild strawberry, just perfectly ripe. And he plucked it, and he ate it, and he thought, isn't life sweet?
I love that story, and I want you to know, but this is one of the reasons, Joel, Eric, why I love this story in particular. You know, all of the stories in The Beggar King, you know, comes from cultural seeds, as I'd like to refer to them. But, you know, for example, when I talk about this story in class, I tell them, okay, think about another character, think about another location, think about another place you're going, think about any year, think about another name, think about anyone. It doesn't make any difference. And the story still works, right? The story still works. So you could be, always wondered if I wanted to be a lawyer, and I got this great, you know, job interview. And then it's really always funny because a lawyer is about to be eaten by two tigers. Get it? Yeah, they love it. But in any event, it doesn't make any difference. It's always a great story. It's so transferable. And that's what I love about all of the stories in Beggar King in particular. You know, it was a year I literally counted blessings, grateful for everything that I have. And one of the quick stories, although it may not sound applicable, it is to me, one of the quick stories that always come to mind in terms of blessing, being happy with what you have, is one day there was a boy walking down a road when a frog called his name. You guys might know this story, or listeners may. Boy, if you kiss me, I'll turn into a beautiful princess. And the boy picks up the frog, smiles at it, and places the frog in his pocket. And a few minutes later, the frog says, boy, if you kiss me and turn me back into a beautiful princess, I'll stay with you for a week. And the boy took the frog from his pocket, smiled at it, put it back in his pocket. And a few minutes later, the frog said, boy, if you kiss me and turn me back into a beautiful princess, I'll do anything you want. And the boy took the frog from his pocket, smiled, put it back. And finally, the frog cried, boy, what is the matter? I've told you that I am a beautiful princess. If you kiss me, I'm going to stay with you and do anything you want. Well, the boy took the frog from his pocket and said, look, I'm a graduate student in engineering. I don't have any time for a girlfriend, but a talking frog is very cool. Yeah, so it's a ridiculous story, although my 9-year-old grandson likes it. And, you know, which tells you how I think, but it's about, what do you have? You know, a talking frog would be great. I don't need to change it, right? And I looked around me all year looking at things that I had, so fortunate that I had them. Great friends, a magnificent spouse, you know, a son who actually respects me, grandson who will actually talk to me, actually text me. Okay, but I mean, all the sorts of things that you wish you had, simple stuff. And when I was ill at Methodist, I thought about it all, realizing how very powerful it was. So I had a lot of very cool frogs. I didn't want to change.
I will bet, you know, it's one of the ironies of modern life is that it gives us almost everything except for the ability to appreciate what we have.
We have about 10 minutes left. Because this spine story, by the way, I got to tell you, this whole story, spine story, I love that. So I'm glad that we spend time on that. But with about 10 minutes left, I want to deal with this notion of life and death, Joel. And you've got a couple of stories that you want to weave in. You said you wanted to ask me a few questions. Let's have some fun with that.
All right. I like the idea of having some fun with life and death, because death often feels...
Yeah, no kidding.
Great. And, you know, I just... On the topic of fun and with life and death, I watched a Pixar film recently. Over the years, I've taught at Pixar, Story Skills for Movie Makers. It's local for me. I live in Berkeley. It's in Emeryville. And their new movie, Soul, has some fun with life and death. And it's very much that that idea of sort of that appreciation of what you have. And, you know, there's something about stories. I guess it was Walter Benjamin said, storytellers borrow their authority from death. That's where we get from the Jewish German philosopher. And it's been said with stories that there's really two main stories. One, either someone goes on a journey, or two, a stranger comes to town. And death is a little bit of both of those. Death is that stranger coming to town and someone going on a journey and how they meet. So what I love are stories in that liminal zone on the edge of of life and death. And I'm thinking of an old King Solomon story, which is there's different versions, but I think of it as a King Solomon story, where of the great leaders, he was the only one who had the power to summon people at will. In my book, he summons Asmodai, king of the demons. And he once had an advisor come to him, and the advisor was just pale, shaken. And he said to the advisor, he said, well, what's wrong? The advisor said, I was just in the marketplace here in Jerusalem, and I saw death. Death turned and looked right at me, just stared at me wide-eyed. Do something, Solomon. And Solomon had an idea, said, you know what? I have an idea. I can't stop death, but I know there's one place in my dominion where death cannot enter. That is the city of Luz. In my stable, take my white horse. It's the fastest. Get on that horse and gallop. Gallop to the city of Luz. Once you're inside there, you're safe from death. And without hesitation, the advisor jumped on that horse, galloped off, and then Solomon summoned death to the palace in Jerusalem and said, Death, what are you doing? Scaring my advisor like that, that shock, that look, you terrified him. And Death said, I'm sorry. I did not mean to scare him, but in truth, I was the one who was shocked. Solomon said, why? Death said, I was shocked to see him in the marketplace, for I knew full well I had an appointment to see him this evening, just outside the gates of the city of Luz.
I love that. Yeah.
And that story is the variation is Appointment at Samara, and that became the novel by John O'Hara, 1944, and it's also a chapter, The Appointment, I think it's called, in The Beggar King. So that's an intriguing one. But you know, there's something about the stories about death really touch on us in a way that make us appreciate and laugh. I remember there was a rabbinic story about two rabbis. They spent their lives arguing about what it would be like to die. And they finally, and these rabbis stroke their beards, have Talmudic opinion, blah, 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 back and forth. And finally they come with agreement. They say, whichever one of us dies first, let's have the other one come back and tell what it's like. And sure enough, eventually one of them dies. And before long, he returns to the first in a dream. He said, so how was it? How was it to die? And he said, when my soul was removed from my body, it was done as gently as though a hair was being lifted from a pail of milk. Even so, had I to do it again, I would not live life for fear of death. It's a kind of a Jewish story with almost a Zen
feel. Well, the Jewish stories and the Zen stories, I don't know, Eric, I don't know what your take is. But, the common denominator is it sounds like it's not a very profound thought, but you really have to focus on the moment. There isn't anything. And, Judaism is predicated on that notion anyway. My friend Seymour Rosell, will always say to me when I ask him about death, he'll say, don't worry about it. I said, what do you mean don't worry about it? He says, what are you going to worry about? What are you going to possibly worry about? You want me from advice? I'm not dead yet. I can't give you any. And, I'm thinking about this guy's a comedian. He is. But that's how he looks at things. He said, focus on what you're doing right now. People love you. You're doing good things. Your wife loves you. Your children love you. Your dog is crazy about you. You're good at what you do. It's okay. Everything else will somehow be okay. Now, that didn't answer my question, but somehow it was satisfying. Eric, what do you think?
Oh, yeah. What I think about all these stories is that common theme like you're talking about is living in the present and experiencing what is, rather than in the future, in the past, whatever. That seems to really really come home in a lot of these stories. And
that's
kind of the take I get on that kind of a story.
Maybe I can end with a little one, the Herschel tale.
Please.
Herschel Ostropol. We have just enough time for that.
I should
just mention Herschel. Herschel was the court jester of Rabbi Baruch. Rabbi Baruch was the grandson of the Baal Shem Tov, who I just found out is a relative. I didn't realize this. Rabbi Israel the Baal Shem Tov, somebody traced genetics and said, oh, you're related to the Rabbi Israel the Baal Shem Tov, to his mother. So anyways, Rabbi Baal Shem Tov was famous. Rabbi Baruch was sort of a disaster. He hired Herschel as a court jester to sort of distract from all his mistakes and foibles. And of course, Herschel of Ostropol, spent his entire life making jokes at the expense of Rabbi Baruch. And we had a dog who, may his memory be for a blessing, we named Herschel in honor of Herschel. Herschel, our dog, who was a Cavalier King Charles Spaniel, he passed away just over a year ago. But we named him Herschel because he was just so happy and had just this sense of joy in life. We said, you're the least Jewish dog ever. We played Leonard Cohen for him. Nothing could get him to sort of see the dark side. But that reminded me in a fitting way of Herschel of Ostropol. So Herschel had spent his whole life making jokes about Rabbi Baruch, but finally Herschel was on his deathbed. And as they gathered around, people said, Herschel, this is the end. And Rabbi Baruch said, Herschel, you've spent your whole life making jokes. Now will you at least be serious? And he said, what's the point in starting now? He said, Herschel, in a moment, the angel of death will come here to ask you your name. What will you say? He said, I'll tell him it's Moses. But it's not, as Herschel. So if you knew, why did you ask? Herschel, he'll ask what you've done. Have you mended your ways? Have you mended the world? I'll tell him I've mended my socks. This, Herschel's eyes began to glaze over. He looked up. He said, I'm going now. But I have one last request. Come close. People leaned in and he said, I just beg of you, when you put me in my coffin, please do not hold me under my arms. And with that, he closed his eyes and died. They looked, they stared, they waited. They said, Herschel, why? Herschel opened his eyes and from the world beyond, he said, I've always been a little ticklish there. You know, this was a story I told at my father's funeral, 1986. And in my mother's funeral, I whispered it because I couldn't speak at the time. And may we live and die with a joke on our lips. May we be able to see humor in this new year. And may we be able to appreciate what we have as we go to the well. And thank you both. And Hank, I
don't hate anything in life, but I hate ending this kind of a show. I've always hated ending the show because it's such a labor of love. But I love having you on, Joel, and the idea of seeing you is so meaningful. I know I speak for Eric. Tonight, thanks to Mr. Joel Ben-Izzy, we went to the well, discovering the story in you, and in fact, embracing the true mission of this program. Thank you, Joel, for your signature style, always fueled by humor and wisdom. You prove one of my favorite Native American proverbs. Tell me the facts and I'll learn. Tell me the truth and I'll believe. Tell me a story and it will live in my heart forever. I'm hoping that you're going to agree to continue to be a perennial guest on this program. And thank you, my friend and co-host Eric Keen, for your wit, loyalty, and unfathomable love of story. After we enjoy some appropriate Lesmer music from the Barcelona Orchestra, Lars is going to be up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters on the Tennyson tape decks. Be sure to make 90.1 a part of everyday life. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story and Treasure What You Hear. You keep loving a great story, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. This is Hank, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we always want you to remember that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
As a KPFT listener, you have a special opportunity to shorten on-air fundraising by pre-pledging securely online at kpft.org before the on-air portion of the drive begins. We count on listeners like you to contribute to the success of each fund drive, and we thank you for your generous and continued support of KPFT. Since listeners' support is what sustains the station, on-air pledge drives are necessary to inspire other KPFT listeners to become listener supporters. But wouldn't it be nice if the on-air portion of the pledge drive were a bit shorter? With your online gift, you can help shorten the on-air drive so we can get you back to the KPFT programming you enjoy. Pre-pledge securely online at kpft.org so that we have it in hand in time to create the final on-air schedule. And thank you again for your continued support of 90.1 KPFT Houston, kpft.org worldwide.
When you purchase the latest TV, tablet, or smartphone, don't forget to do the right thing with your old ones. Recycle them. The Consumer Technology Association and its members are making recycling your old devices as easy as buying new ones. Just go to greenergadgets.org, type in your zip code, and you'll instantly find the recycling location closest to your home. You'll also find recycling tips, like asking the store where you buy your new TV if they'll haul away your old one. Don't let your old tech tools clog your local landfill. Just visit greenergadgets.org. KPFT Houston.
Natural Awakenings is Houston's premier healthy living magazine. Locally produced, Natural Awakenings' mission is to provide insights and information on natural health, nutrition, fitness, green living, and more. Each issue features articles written by nationally recognized authors and local experts. Available for free at newsstands around town or online at naturalawakenings-houston.com. This is KPFT Houston.